Well, boy, it's been a while. In fact, in the time since we last recorded an episode, Airbus have built and shipped 430 A320 family aircraft across the world. And yes, we checked. That is a real stat. As you can probably imagine, the aviation industry has erupted with all sorts of crazy happenings that we need to talk about. So, in no particular order, let's have a look at the headlines for the top stories since September of last year. The FAA is under incredible pressure from the public and the US government as ATC outfits nationwide talk of their understaffing woes and truly fatal examples of the infrastructure issues that the FAA are facing, rearing their head on multiple occasions from Newark to Washington. China Southern says enough is enough for the Boeing 787, electing to put their entire fleet of the aircraft type on sale to the highest bidder. Global Airlines finally goes wheels up. Or does it? Lots to unpack there about their supposed launch. WSI becomes the first arterial airport in Australia to operate under a fully remote ATC stand. And as for the future of low-cost carriers, Michael O'Leary was right? Standing seats on offer in a new European low-cost carrier. Emirates CEO Tim Clark has announced that Emirates is the most profitable airline of 2025. Mr. Clark has also implored Airbus to reopen the A380 factory lines, but also expects Airbus to foot the bill to reopen them. And of course, the world's most renowned airlines unveil their next-gen first and business class products. Many legacy carriers begin to continue to push each other towards greater and more popular onboard products. And yet, despite being about to take delivery of their first A321neo XLR, Qantas are notably absent from this list. Oh, and something strange is happening at Amsterdam. More on that soon. The USA say enough is enough when it comes to unpublished flight delays. Comedian Nathan Fielder explores the captain first officer dynamic in a new season of his show, The Rehearsal. Oh, and speaking of, what happens when a captain gets locked out of the cockpit? Surprisingly, not a hypothetical. So yes, there's much to talk about. It's time to get into it. Without further ado, this is the Radio Runway Podcast.
And welcome back, everybody. It has been a one-year hiatus, but we are back. We are tearing up the airwaves for you here tonight. How are we going? I'm here, joined here with Tom. I'm also G'day. Joined here with special guest, Tom's dad, Scott Conway. How are we all going tonight?
Excellent. Great to be back. Has it really been September since the last one?
September. Oh, crazy, isn't it, to think?
Okay, yeah. Maybe not quite a year. But it has been such a long time.
It's been a long hiatus.
Time for Tom to get married in the meantime.
Yes, actually, I am now hitched since the last episode. That's crazy.
That's crazy. And you've been on your honeymoon as well, which was...
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Been on the honeymoon as well. And so much has happened in the aviation industry. And also on top of that, because so much has happened, given we all work in the aviation industry, it's like... It's compounded in our workload and hence why we've struggled to get back on the airwaves. But we're here and we've got a lot to discuss.
Talk about your honeymoon, mate. You had an interesting set of flights, didn't you? It wasn't straightforward.
I did, actually. I did, yeah. I decided to go with Emirates across to the US. Sort of a last minute attempt, actually, to get across there. Mm. And I explored Dubai Airport. A series of circumstances actually meant that I had 7 hours to explore Dubai Airport, which is a bit fun. And then actually ended up going via Heathrow from Dubai to JFK. A really weird set of circumstances that is sort of overcomplicated to go into. But basically, I got to try out Virgin Atlantic's product as well, which is pretty cool, in premium economy there, which is really nice. And then JetBlue Mint. And to think, 3 different episodes in our series, I have piled on JetBlue for flying narrow-body services transatlantic, saying, it's the worst thing, blah, blah, blah. But, guys, let me tell you, I sat there in the comfort of what I would now confidently say is one of the best narrow-body business class products on the market for the price as well, and it was insane. I will not complain. As long if I can travel like that every time.
There are very few single aisle issues that can't be solved by sitting up at the pointy end.
Yeah, that's very true, actually.
So you've been on wide body business class as well. How would you say that the narrow body business class on JetBlue stacks up to the wide bodies?
I can't believe how much space they pack into that product. It's the same amount of space as you would get on a a wide body. I don't know why more airlines don't take the diagonal business class approach like that. I've heard rumblings that it's not particularly profitable, but also it could just be that they were banking on being able to acquire Spirit and that was what was going to keep them afloat. But it's hard to say. I thought the product was great. I hope more narrow body services across legacy carriers go down that route. Even like something like your Arab carriers being able to put their 737s and 320s, a business class product like that, rather than just have like a basic business class and focus on solely wide body service, you know. But yeah, anyway.
Yeah. They don't seem to be skimming out a lot. I mean, obviously they don't have the lounges, but they're definitely giving you all the olives, unlike American Airlines, you know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. Exactly. And actually, that brings us really to the first point, which is our next-gen first-class products that have been launched across the world, all of our legacy carriers, one by one. CX in particular, Cathay.
Yeah. There's been a lot. I'll start off with CX, the new Aria suites. They look amazing, to be honest. I mean, they're not revolutionary. A lot of people won't say that they're revolutionary, but they've got doors now on the suites, which is
becoming the new standard, isn't it?
It's becoming the new standard, yeah. Like, people slighted Emirates with their 350s and the 777 retrofit, and they went, oh, it has no doors, no good. So the new standard now is that we're going to have doors, which offers a level of privacy.
Yeah.
A part of me thinks that Emirates didn't go for doors on their 350s and their 777s just to keep their first class a bit more competitive, whereas, as my understanding goes, Cathay aren't going to have first class on the 777-300E. I mean, the 777X is where they're going to launch first class, but obviously we don't know when the 777X is going to start. I mean, they say the end of 2026, but when was it originally meant to launch? Like, pre-COVID. So, you know, take everything you hear with a grain of salt with that aircraft. But, yeah, it looks good. There's some really cool things in that suite. The screen is like 23.5 Ultra HD. It's a really cool thing on it as well. It shows you on the screen which bathrooms are occupied and which ones aren't. So you can literally see from your seat, you know, the aft bathrooms are taken. So don't even bother going there, but the front bathroom's free. So you definitely go there.
Interesting.
And they've played around with this thing. They've installed like little art features in the sky. It's a bit gimmicky, but, you know, it's kind of cool. You know,
was that on the roof? Or is that all?
Nah, it's in the galleys. So they'll have they'll have a piece of art that was made by a local Hong Kong artist.
And so it's real art. It's not just
it is real art. Yeah, they'll have it in the galley somewhere, and it's meant to be a space where you can a communal space where people can hang out. Like, you know, it's no A380 bar or anything, but you know, but I think Virgin Atlantic have done a really good job in terms of like communal spaces on an aircraft that's not a 380. They have like
the 78.
The 78.
When I was on there, they actually had that communal bar space. Obviously, I only just walked past it. I wasn't seated near it, but their wide body sort of is between business and premium economy service. Sort of like that is like a sort of middle ground there that they've met with that bar. Like the area where the bar is, and it's diagonal, similar to JetBlue, and they maximize their seating in that area. But yes, it was incredible. It was this massive bar on an aircraft. It took up so much space. I'm thinking that cannot be an efficient use of space to maximize your profit per seat margin, but your ASKs. But yeah, hey, it was there and it was cool, you know?
So maybe the bar's not gone forever once the A380 goes, hey? But that's another discussion that we're going to have a bit later. As for other airlines that have recently upgraded, Qatar have launched their next-gen Q suites, which is scheduled to launch on the 777X, which, as we've said before, we don't know when that's going to launch. I was reading somewhere that if 777X gets further delayed, because the seats are pre-manufactured and they're actually in Doha at the moment, so the way they were going to have it was that the 777X would be flown to Doha completely stripped out rather than actually like fitted. Okay. Yeah. And they'd fit the actual seats in Doha, because one of the things they're having issues with at the moment is seats, supply chain with the seats.
Getting them to the factories in the US.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So basically they're trying to get as many seats as they can to Doha, stockpile them there, and then at least, you know,
I got them.
Yeah, at least they got them, and at least they can deliver on their promise that we're going to have a brand new product on the 777X. So if that doesn't come on time, there's a possibility that maybe they might retrofit some of the A350s with them.
Oh, yeah.
But so far, it's the Q-Suite 2.
Didn't look that massively different. Everything's just a bit bigger, and you know, the dividing screen's taller, the screen's a bit bigger. The interesting thing, they've got Starlink for the internet.
Oh, right.
350 megabits per second Starlink, which is...
That's cool. I feel like that's the inroads to the future of onboard Wi-Fi, really.
That is. Yeah, it has been rolled out on Qatar's 777s. So I have seen a few of them. A few of them do come into Melbourne. And
Nice.
They do have the Starlink sticker.
On the side of the aircraft.
On the side of the aircraft, because originally the ones that they use are Arido, which is like a Qatari network provider. Right. But they've gotten rid of that, and the ones that are installed with Starlink have the Starlink on the side. But that, yeah, I'd agree. The Starlink is cool because most in-flight Wi-Fi.
Just check your emails and maybe your Facebook if you're lucky, but not streaming.
Yeah, you're not streaming videos. Totally. You're definitely not like looking through TikTok, none of that. You're just replying to people messages, and it takes like 5 minutes for that anyway.
Whereas having a geostationary orbit network of satellites... You can probably provide stable internet coverage for the entire flight, which is pretty cool. The other thing on that is, on the Q Suite, I would say what you said about it being larger and better. I'm going to cut that bit out. What you said about it being larger and sort of everything slightly more polished and bigger and better, I would say that is akin to a lot of industries where the gold standard product ain't broke and don't need fixing because it is the gold standard. And so you just sort of tweak a few things, make a few updates, but you keep the core product the same.
Yeah.
Like the iPhone, Sennheiser with their headphones, like name brand stuff doesn't need changing if you already meet the market, like number one, number two spots, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think Q-Suite 2, new next-gen Q-Suite, it looks amazing in that. But even with all the new business class products that are getting phased in, everyone's going to... I think Q-Suite still ranks number one.
Mm.
There's still something about Q-Suites. And it's the hard product and it's the soft product as well. It's stuff like a la carte dining, which not a lot of carriers offer in business class.
Yeah.
You know, now they're offering caviar as service, for example, in business class on certain routes. It's stuff like that that makes it the best business class in the world, and that's not me saying that. That's
it's interesting, though, because obviously Q-Suite's been around for, 6 or 7 years now.
Yeah.
And people, these other airlines we're talking about, are now launching their catch-up product.
Yeah.
Right when they're going to the next level. They're still ahead.
Yeah. They are, ironically, given we were talking about Starlink, they are the SpaceX equivalent to the airline industry when it comes to business products. SpaceX are 10 years ahead of the next space exploration company in terms of product, and Qatar maybe 5 or 6 years, but like they are leading the market in terms of what comes next. I will say I've seen the Aria suite, as you said, with Cathay. It is incredible. Don't get me wrong. It's like it is on par with Q-Suite 1, but the fact that Qatar are already going, oh, well, we have our next product.
Yeah.
Coming out right as Cathay's going, bang, we've got a competitor for Q-Suite. It's interesting. Yeah.
Though, having said that, Qatar and Cathay don't exactly have many overlapping, if any, overlapping routes, do they?
No, they don't have a lot of overlapping.
Qatar to Hong Kong, maybe.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, also, I know also Lufthansa and Delta and Lufthansa, Delta, and then also allegedly Air New Zealand have also released, quote, next-gen products. I put allegedly on Air New Zealand because their next-gen product is still woeful.
I wouldn't say so. I mean, I'd say that, look, I've never flown Air New Zealand business class. I've walked past the cabin. It's not great. Like, it's a lie-flat product.
I hate the look and feel of it.
But
apparently, the seats are comfortable. I haven't flown them, but that just looks terrible.
Yeah.
The layout. Because if they're all full, all you can see looking down the aisles is all these feet with no shoes on sticking out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know what? That's the one downside, I will say, also, of the the VS Virgin Atlantic.
Well, it's the same seat.
Exactly. It's the same seat. There you go. Same product.
Two main airlines that did that. And stuck with it for
not ideal. No, but yeah, Delta's product, great.
But Delta's product looks pretty good. UA launched a new Polaris suite, which will be...
Because neither of those airlines offer first class, do they? They just have that sort of premium business is their thing.
Mm. No. Mm. And I think American Airlines is shifting away now from its first class. Yeah. It's going to...
That's a first class, really, slowly.
Do you see that Allegra, the new Allegra first class suite on Lufthansa? On Lufthansa,
yeah.
The middle suite is like the biggest... It's the same size as it's probably not as big as
The double combined Q suite
as a Singapore one.
Oh, Singapore, right? Yeah,
suites,
yeah.
But it's got two seats together in the only one screen. It's got one like massive screen
and
it's
one
like
mega screen.
Mega across.
Oh, geez.
They both seats go down independently, but there's only the one screen. It looks really comfortable. It's a weird kind of combo.
Does that mean they've sort of pseudo locked themselves into one passenger or a couple?
Well, you have to. Yeah, we can either. Yeah, exactly. You're gonna have to fly with someone you know pretty well.
Yeah.
Pretty cozy in there.
Don't want to argue about what you're going to watch on the telly. No, exactly.
But, there's the Allegris and there's the Allegris business class as well. I mean, this isn't new. I mean, it's new to be rolled out, but the concept isn't new at all. Like, it got released in 2018 or something like that. Lufthansa has just been painfully slow in actually getting the product out to the market.
They've been really slow because, this stuff's been on the drawing board for a long time.
Really?
But I watched this Nonstop Dan review. Shout out Nonstop Dan. Yes. And he was saying that in the business class suite alone, there are five different types of seats that you can purchase.
Types of product.
Yeah, the products that you can purchase. Yeah. You get the bog standard one as standard, but like your business class, if you want something a bit nicer, like a window seat or like they call them like throne seats or like at the front of the aircraft, there's like, you know, at the front of most like new business class suites, there's like, the extra large suite that you pay a bit extra for. So like Virgin Atlantic A330neo is one that comes to mind.
JetBlue Mint Studio versus
exactly. Something like
Malaysian
that.
Malaysian does it as well.
Mm. Oh, Malaysian, really? There you go. Yeah.
Stuff like that. You pay for it, but you get the bog standard seat on Lufthansa Allegris and anything beyond that. Like even if you want a proper window seat, you need to pay for it, which is absurd in business class. Like I know Qatar do it. You pay for seat selection in business class if you on a saver ticket, same British Airways, which I think's so absurd. Like it's business class. Like, come on.
Yeah, it depends who's paying for it at the end of the day. One of the reasons that Malaysia went away from its first class product but had this premium business class in the first row, it's bigger and everything, but they called it business premier. And one of the main reasons they did it is that a lot of company travel policies are you can go business, you can't go first class. So as long as it's got business in the name,
you work clever.
It through on work travel.
So the common working man's ally, Malaysian Airlines. Goodness me. Hey, actually also, talk to us, Nick, about the Riyadh Air cabin product. Has there been any news on that?
Yeah, so they released that. Where did they release that? I think they released it in Dubai. You have to fact check this to me on that. They released. I know they released the cabin crew uniform in Paris. There was a whole fashion show around it. Tony Douglas is making a real big deal about this whole. So Tony Douglas, by the way, is the CEO of Riyadh Air, who is the ex CEO of Etihad.
I did not know
obviously knows his stuff, but I think the way he describes Riyadh Air. It's not really an airline. It's like a lifestyle product.
Yeah,
that's what he's trying to make it. And that's what Cathay are trying to do as well. They're trying to become like a lifestyle brand, which is why a lot of Cathay now, they're moving away from Cathay Pacific to just Cathay. So you can, you know.
There you go. For the viewers, listeners at home, I've just pulled up. If you actually go to riyadhair.com, their base opening cabin reveal page has some incredible graphics around the product that's actually offered in business.
So he's so called it Business Elite.
Business Elite. There you go. Your room in the sky. There you go. So lie flat, of course. And the economy product looks very similar to what you get on most legacy carriers, really.
Yeah, my understanding is they sourced the product from Collins Aerospace.
Okay.
That's the underpinnings of the whole product. Like, obviously, they've played around with it, made it. There's, you know, obviously the Riyadh scheme, but I think they're trying to make this a lifestyle sort of
nice
brand rather than an airline.
Except they're going to be and I'll segue into here, and they're advertising for pilots at the moment.
Yeah, they are.
Yes.
Did you see their packages they're offering?
No. Oh, actually, no, I did. It was advertised yesterday. It is insane.
Captains, $31,000 US a month.
Yeah.
Plus overtime, plus expat housing, of course, a high-end accommodation feature.
High-end accommodation.
Pools, gyms and full
goodness.
Amenities. Free school fees for up to 3 children, including schools outside of Saudi Arabia.
Oh, boarding school style.
One annual business class return ticket to home country and 20 confirmed round-trip tickets for friends and family. 1 month Ramadan bonus, a 5% annual pay increase, an entry into a profit-sharing pool, global health and life insurance.
Geez, Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund going to work there, that's for sure. That's nuts. Yeah. And
so you add that to what we just saw and we think, I don't know how it's going to cost to fly in this.
Exactly.
Thing like
and you're right. It is a good segue because there is a global pilot shortage, especially rearing its ugly head in the US, where the average age of pilots across legacy carriers at the moment is 62. And that's like for captains, I should say. Sorry, first officers, obviously there's those on the grind. I mean, even as we'll talk about with Nathan Fielder's show later in the picture, there are first officers with upwards of 6,000 to 7,000 hours on type and time in command enough to be able to be upgraded into the command seat. But there's a huge deficit in training pilots. There's a huge deficit in young captains to continue the wealth of knowledge that the older pilots have and to pass on. There's going to be a generational pilot training infrastructure shortfall that's going to occur sometime in the next 10 years. US airlines are lobbying the US government at the moment, and lobbying Congress to increase the retirement age, the sort of mandatory retirement age for pilots in the US, so that they can put them to work a bit longer while they, quote unquote, figure out the problem. Although it seems like there's institutional issues that are really roadblocking anything actually being done about decreasing the average age of command of captains across airlines in the US. And yeah, there is, and it's not just in the US, but it's rearing its head in the US. There's a similar problems in Australia, there's similar problems in New Zealand, Asia. It is a worldwide thing. It could also be that flying is still really expensive to learn unless there's a heavy infrastructure already in place. Like in the US, I suppose it might be a little bit cheaper than it is here in Australia. We can certainly say that it's ridiculously expensive here in Australia to learn.
It is.
Yeah. I could say probably the Arab carriers, something like Emirates Training Pilot Training Academy, they'd probably subsidize or fully pay for local Arab region pilots to train and become cadets on the aircraft.
They do, yeah, they do. Like Emirates have their own cadetship program. I think you can get into it as an expat. Obviously, they're going to favor the locals a bit more. Like, they have their own program as well where they select a certain few local people
to
train down in Adelaide or Miami.
Yeah, hey, you know who's been through the Cadetship Academy in Emirates?
I have beef cheek.
Our good friend Sam Chewy.
The video, yeah. I did see the video flying the Cirrus SR-22s. I've seen that.
Yes, big time. Yeah. Sorry. Yes. So, no, pilot shortages, it's a big thing to keep on everyone's radar because it's not going away anytime soon.
Yeah.
And we haven't got any real solutions in place at the moment.
Yeah, this technology is something where technology really hasn't made a huge impact. You know, you'd think AI would be flying the planes by now. Or even ATC, you know, still quite, well, there's a lot of computerization. You're still requiring at least one person up there, the control tower, which we'll talk about in a minute. But that would be crying out. I would have thought for some sort of, you know, automation. There's no reason these planes can't land themselves.
Yeah, it is the one point of the, it's the one phase of the flight which is purely 100% completely manual on the pilot's front. They are landing the aircraft every time. There's three autopilots.
It's the QF-32, the A380 out of Singapore, that one. You know, that's the poster child for saying you'll have to have people on board because the computer, when that one in a zillion thing happens, which it can't happen, you need actual humans, not
I still think AI people want people on board. Like, if you ask the majority of the public.
They do. And it's a mental thing. They'd have that with trains. I mean, there are some countries where their subway, Singapore or even Sydney now, the new metro line, I think it's all driverless. But that's been the technologies for 30, 40 years. And I know when they built the Jubilee line in the UK, in London, you know, they put drivers on there. They didn't need them, but they didn't think people would get on the train unless they saw someone sitting in the front of it. So
that's crazy, isn't it?
Partly a mindset thing. But
I think it is a mindset thing. I don't know. I personally like the setup that's there.
Yeah.
I like having two pilots, you know, in case something happens. You know,
cross-check's important.
Someone's got to hold the handcuffs for the drunk and disorderly.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Well, you did foreshadow the next thing there, which is that the FAA is having nationwide ATC issues, and it's reared its head in a very fatal way with the American Eagle crash in Washington. And with the helicopter crash collision, a lot of fingers are pointed in the initial phase, which obviously is a lot of emotion that's flown around when hundreds of lives have been lost initially. But ultimately, cooler heads are beginning to prevail, and the microscope was already partially on the FAA, but now it's in full blast, in full view of the FAA. And the FAA, as it turns out, in some areas, especially the ATC division, have been crying out for staff increases for a very long time. There's apparently no budget for it. There's apparently the resources are not there to train professionals that are at the appropriate standard for it. Although I did see a clip of the former US ambassador to Australia the other day talking about how right now there are enough trainees in the FAA training program to equate to the minimum staffing requirement requests put in by the FAA. It's just about the insane rigorous standards of training and the dropout rate. That's the ultimate driving issue. They're held to such a high standard.
Yeah, and you don't want to be dropping standards just to fill your numbers.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Problems. Exactly. Yeah. And you know what? They're still doing the FAA, well, the overarching FAA investigation and ATSB, just FAA investigation into the crash, the American Eagle crash. But initial findings have already shown that the ATC personnel follow protocol in every portion of the incident, and it was unfortunately the fault of the helicopter pilot in misinterpreting who the ATC was talking to specifically. Finings, and so I'd say that that's enough of a white flag to say that, yeah, the ATC, the professionals are doing their job to an appropriate standard. It was unfortunate on the part of the helicopter and the helicopter pilot. And then let's talk also then on the issue of ATE staff shortages, the incident in Newark about a month and a half ago, where it came out that for a period of a few hours, the entire aerodrome was being staffed by one person in the tower. And on top of that, compounding, the equipment is so old at Newark that the CEO of Newark Airport was the one that said that some portions of their infrastructure still run off floppy disks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And on top of that, because of the aging infrastructure, everything went dark for 2 minutes. Or it was like a minute and 20 seconds. I don't know the exact, but it's in the realm of 2 minutes. Everything went fully dark. There are recordings of transmissions made from the tower to different aircraft saying, "We have no eyes. We don't know where you are. Can you report where you are?"
Can you look out the window and wait?
Exactly. For 2 minutes, it was a fully unpoliced airspace. And, you know, there's the pilot's ultimate eyes to make sure they're not crashing into other aircraft comes from ATC because of how wide of a scope of area they're working with.
Mm.
It is crazy to think that that's what's happening. So they're, I mean, air traffic control infrastructure in the US, the FAA are crying out for help. And I think it's a no-brainer to anyone listening would probably agree that it's time for funding to be increased, resource allocation to be increased.
Yeah.
It's time to upscale and improve. And apparently there has been a an upgrade program in the works, and it was supposed to be completed something like 10 to 15 years ago, and it still hasn't been completed, like the transition. I just don't understand it. I don't understand it.
Yeah, for someone to single-handedly run the control tower.
It was one qualified person and one trainee, I think.
There you go. Yeah. There you go.
But even for that, even for that level to run a tower at a massive hub like Newark is crazy. Because I think at places like Heathrow, the maximum amount of time that somebody's allowed to operate on shift in one go is 1 hour, and then they have to take a break.
It's just so intense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy. That's the NATS requirement for them. NATS are the guys that run the, it's like the air services of the UK.
Yeah.
But it's 1 hour and that's it. You come off for half an hour, and then you get back on the controls again just because of the high stress levels and the human factor side of it.
While we're on US aviation, I've got just a couple of other quick updates. We talked, I think, last year about the 787 MAX crash.
Yes.
The two of them.
737 MAX.
737
MAX. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he knows something that we don't. Yeah, the 787 is up for a refurb.
It's finally settled, and surprise, surprise, no one's going to jail. Which the attorney for the families of the Ethiopian one that crashed is not happy about.
Yeah, no.
But, why would you be?
So Boeing are paying $445 million. These are US dollars. $444.5 million to the families of the crash victims. They're paying another $455 million. Towards improving its compliance and safety quality programs, and it's paying a criminal penalty of $487 million.
Oh, my goodness.
They've already paid half of that. So that's $1.4
billion. Oh, my gosh.
And they're paying Dennis Muhlenberger's $90 million bonus, so that's all good. He's the bloke that was in charge when that happened.
It's cost them, you know, that's $1.4 billion, but it's cost them a lot more than that just in the chaos that's ensued and the delays getting recertified and all that kind of stuff, the compensation to airlines for delays. That's billions more.
So that's a
complete debacle.
That's what ultimate lack of complacency costs you.
Yeah.
I mean, even to this day, like, you know, not all of the 737 MAX compliant with FAA regulation. The MAX 7 they wanted to bring out, that's not available yet. The MAX 10 as well.
Aren't they ready to throw the MAX 10 in the bin, the program, from what I've heard?
I don't know.
Maybe it's just particular airlines are throwing their MAX 10 orders in the bin.
Maybe they'll throw the MAX 10 in the bin just to look at the 797, which is supposedly the the competitor. Well, Christos is
excited about that one.
Christos is very excited about it. So I thought that the 797 would be a one-for-one competitor of the 321XLR, maybe like a 757 successor, a much more efficient 757 flying pencil, because there is nothing when the 321XLR, well, the 321XLR is already flying, but like that's in a league of its own. There's no real competition for that at the moment. So does Boeing need to do something about it? Do they do the MAX 10, which is, you know, take them that long already.
What do they do when they're in a... What is the right move for... Is it Kelly Ortwell? Is that his name? The new guy? I think it's Kelly Ortwell. What is he and the team in the executive of Boeing to do when public opinion's already out the window? Like, let's forget about that. The FAA is rightfully on your back and should be until you can prove to them that you are, I would say, at least on par with the Airbus safety standards in their factories, production lines, everything. What are they to do in terms of new product? Because and obviously the 777X delays make sense when hearing about it, because it's like there's so many internal issues you have to fix before you can get to the point of delivering a new product, I feel.
Well, it's not just them. I mean, Airbus has its issues. As we know, the engine manufacturer's got huge issues. Just you know, the technology and the complexity, every generation of aircraft is just so much more complex, and it just causes more and more issues. And they still haven't fully recovered from the disruptions from COVID, of course.
Still going.
Oh, nothing has. It's all supply chain, and it's all, you know, economic. You know, I mean, like all these tariffs. I mean, look at what airlines are having to do because of that, and you know, suppliers, and look at what's happening with Delta and Airbus, for example.
Yes.
You know, or the other way around. You know, Boeing delivering to Lufthansa.
Yes.
It's not. You know.
Yeah. No.
It's so complex now.
With all these issues, especially in US aviation, I'd be pleased to know that Senator Rick Scott of the US Senate has got a new legislation up to address one of the big issues in aviation.
Oh, please tell me.
That is, if your flight's delayed more than 15 minutes, the airline needs to tell you why.
Jeez.
So, as you know, when you have an act, you've got to have a catchy acronym. So this is the FLIGHT Act.
Yeah.
Anyone guess what FLIGHT stands for?
Federal? Is the first one federal? FLIGHT. Oh, no.
The Frequent Logistics Information for Grounded and Held Travellers Act.
Oh, they really snuck the four under the radar, didn't they, there? The word four.
With a small F.
It should be fluffed. Fluffed.
So apparently the airlines now, if they're delayed for more than 15 minutes, you have to give an update to people every 15 minutes until their flight.
Is that passed now? Off. Is that in?
No, it's going through. It's going through. It will be lost in the house because no one
could
be.
Yeah. Man.
Some grandstanding.
But good to see the pressing issues of American aviation making it through. The FAA must be rolling their eyes at every opportunity hearing something like that. Sure, hold airlines to account for delays, but maybe...
It's going
to
be exactly the same because all you get now is, for operational reasons, there's been a delay.
Yeah.
Because people really want to know that the flight crew's sick or that someone's been stranded from a connecting flight and can't get there.
That is one thing I can safely say working at an airline that I won't get in trouble saying with is that 9 times out of 10, when we need a delay reason code to feed through to passengers afterwards, it's delayed due to operational circumstances. Sure, like
airlines don't really want to know. Actually, airlines don't want you to know the real reason.
You can, exactly. You can. I mean, we stretch the definition of operational circumstances. We stretch it. But you have to, ultimately. Also, I'm going to back check myself. It's Kelly Ortberg, not Ortwell.
I was going to say Ortberg, but no, that's all right. It's good.
And just before we move on from the manufacturing issues, I will tell you a funny story that's come out of Airbus this week.
Yes, please.
We've had it's got supply chain issues. They had a slight delay in the Airbus factory in Canada.
Oh, so that'd be A220s probably?
Make them A220s,
yeah.
It was the A220s. Because of chewed wires and raccoon urine. Because a family of raccoons got into one of the planes and peed everywhere and chewed through the wire.
No. Hey, AirBaltic. Yeah, sorry. We're going to be a couple of weeks late on your delivery for the next A220. Yeah, look, nothing major. Just a couple of raccoons have pissed on some of the wires and they've come a bit loose. So we just got to get an exterminator team in and then fix up the wiring. It's no big issue. Don't worry about it.
Sounds like the most quintessential Canadian problem to have. It's like if aircraft were manufactured in Australia and a kangaroo just like punched the hull or something like that.
Kangaroo punch. Oh, yeah. Kangaroos are a thing at Melbourne Airport, aren't they? I'm sure they are at other airports around Australia, but like, you know, out on the airfield, always being monitored. But bunny rabbit warrens. I'm sure wildlife is a huge thing across every airport, really, because of the zones where most of them are.
I feel as though Melbourne's a bit more of an issue because Melbourne's a bit more, it's a bit more rural.
Partially rural.
I say that. Like, you know, like look at Kingsford Smith. I mean, that's as metro as you're going to get. Yeah, Brisbane's pretty, you know, Port of Brisbane's around it. You got suburbs around it. And Adelaide's pretty close in
there
as well.
There was an aircraft accident in Martinique in the Caribbean a few years back, where a plane landed, and as it was still zooming down the runway, a donkey walked out in front of it, hit the donkey.
Oh, my gosh. No.
And not the donkey. I was reading the global air crashes for that month, and it's, you know, crashed in bad weather and mountainous terrain.
Yeah.
And this one hit donkey. It's the official cause of crash.
Imagine the pilot calling the manager, yeah, we've had a crash. Oh, really? What's the cause? Ah, some ass. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Jeez. Well, we've spoken a lot about production infrastructure.
We have. I want a segue.
Yes.
We've talked about, obviously, we've talked about a pilot shortage. We've talked about ATC shortage. We've talked about supply chain issues. What is fascinating throughout all of this is that airlines are still turning profits, and not small ones, but big ones. I want to turn to Emirates, who have just posted a $5.2 billion profit, which makes them the most profitable airline in the world. And Singapore Airlines posted something like $2 billion or something like that. So airlines are making money. Despite all of this stuff that's going on, that they can't get new aircraft.
Yeah, no.
You know, they're not getting their newest products out as quickly as they want to, but they're still making massive profits, which is crazy.
Yeah.
It's also helped, I mean, those airlines you mentioned are good operators, but things as simple as the fact that there is a shortage of aircraft means they can revalue the existing aircraft upwards. Like their existing aircraft are worth more, and therefore that feeds through as an accountant.
Yeah,
so your depreciation amortization charge, which is a big chunk of writing off the value of your fleet.
Yeah,
so that's right there back up again.
Because it's crazy.
Because the secondhand market is so good for decent planes at the moment.
Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
Yeah, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. Obviously, we've seen there's obviously some of the airlines are making profit under malicious circumstances too. Here at home, obviously, there's a Senate inquisition, or has been a Senate inquisition, into Qantas's ghost flights as well. That's something that's on the radar. A Jetstar even as well were a little bit under the radar as well because of keeping fare prices high, same with VA. The market in Australia, because it's so isolated, that is a problem.
I think the other thing too is because of the shortage of replacement aircraft, you know, airlines from time to time will, you know, flood capacity into particular routes to try and buy market share, that kind of thing. No one's doing that at the moment because they just haven't got that capacity.
Yeah.
And they're flying their
380s?
They're not retiring aircraft as quickly, but their capacity, you know, when the last time you were in a plane and saw a plane that was half empty, you know, it's the load factors are very good,
that is
especially
true.
Internationally.
Yes.
And that obviously helps because once your costs are covered at whatever percentage, everything else is gravy.
Yeah, the load factors are crazy. I mean, Emirates to London, for example. I mean, UK is Emirates' biggest market by far. And you look at the flights, so they do 7 daily A380s from Dubai to Heathrow, 3 daily A380s from Dubai to Gatwick, and 1 777 from Stansted daily, and they all fill.
And Manchester and Glasgow and Edinburgh.
Yeah, they do. Manchester, Glasgow, Birmingham, Edinburgh. Birmingham,
yeah. It's like the population of Angola moved in a single day, every day.
But it's all filling up. It's crazy.
Here's a small clip for the listeners, a 40-second clip of what Sir Tim Clark has to say as the president of Emirates about the current their position in the airline market.
Surprisingly, and I speak not only for Emirates but the airline group as a whole, apart from the North American and Canadian situation, demand is very strong. Given the difficulties, socioeconomic, geopolitical, etc., but demand for travel is as strong as it was this time last year and the year before. So I'm kind of fairly optimistic if we can get through all of this and that there aren't major disruptions to the global economy, that things will continue as they are.
So, yes, he's feeling very confident in Emirates' position, and he did note at the start of the clip also that he was speaking on behalf of the broader airline community, because it's true. All airlines are feeling the fruit of the post-COVID travel world.
Yeah, still. You
know, and business increasing again, despite business travel increasing, I would say steadily, despite you know, work from home and Zoom and all the rest of it.
Well, people thought it wouldn't come back. It was a segment that wouldn't come back, business travel, but
he wants Airbus to make the A380 again.
Yes, yes, true, he does.
But when he talked about it, or I heard him talk about it, it sounded like he'd drawn it up on the back of an envelope. Because he had all these ideas about, you know, with composites and stuff to make it lighter and all the rest of it and new engines. And Airbus was like, yeah, it's fine. We need $20 billion, though, to do it. So you give us $20 billion, we'll open our factory up again.
I love it. Yeah.
He's a knowledgeable man, Tim Clark. I mean, he's a legend. If you hear him, like, it isn't just the A380. If you hear him wax lyrical about the 777 as well, because he talks about the 777 in such high regard. I mean, Emirates have 150 of them, and how many 777Xs they have. It's good from passenger
none
front.
At the moment.
Yeah.
Nothing. No 777Xs at the moment. That's why they're refurbishing their 777-300ERs. But the 777-300ER is such a workhorse of an aircraft, which turns 30.
Yeah, so turned 30 in May. Here's a pop quiz for you. How many 777s been delivered?
Totally. Nick would get close. I would have no idea. Go on. Have a guess. Okay, my guess, 800.
Nah, I think it's over a grand.
1,752.
That's crazy.
So they've stopped making the ER, the 300 ER. They stopped that in January, and they're focusing everything on getting the 777X out. I think they're still doing 777 freighters at the moment, but everything's now trying to get the Stirling X out by next year. Sometime.
Jeez, that's nearly as many aircraft as years before Australia was discovered.
It's done. I could write it down. They've done.
There you go. Oh, gosh.
Done over 4 billion miles.
Whoa.
And carried over 4 million passengers.
Oh, my God.
It is an absolute workhorse of an aircraft. It is such a great aircraft. From a passenger perspective, it's really good for uplifting cargo as well. Lot of space in the belly hold to fit your AKEs and your DMCs. And there's a lot of the. It's such a great aircraft. But anyway, going back to what Tim Clark was saying, you can see why he wants the 380. You can see why every other airline doesn't. Yeah. I mean, he's realistically, his business model, well, Emirates' business model, because it isn't just his, has relied so heavily on that particular aircraft type.
But it's their geography. Other than maybe Singapore, they're the only country in the world that really needs a plane like that because of the way they're route network has to be structured just because of where they are and how big they are and all the rest of it. So,
yeah, exactly.
Well, I was saying that you look at an airline that's very close in proximity, like Qatar. Qatar have a very different. I think the business model is the same, but in terms of how they've gone about it with fleet is entirely different. I mean, Qatar have gone for a much more diversified fleet. You know, they got 7-8s, 350s, 777s, you know, 330s. Yeah. Whereas Emirates, for until about 6 months ago, 777s, 380s, that was it. And I think if Tim Clark had his way, you could get the 380s back out again. It'd continue to be like that. Maybe the 350s would have been in there to replace the 777-200s, which they've still got in the fleet.
Yeah.
But
big time.
But I think the 380, like, I get what he's saying. But I think Emirates are the only carriers that actually
has made it fully profitable by going all in. Yeah.
And that's the thing. The only way you're going to get profitable on that aircraft is if you go all in and if you buy loads of them.
You need a wealth fund to be able to upstart quick enough. And the prime example of an airline that wants to do that but doesn't have the financial backing is Global Airlines.
Yeah, well, Global Airlines, hey? That's a very interesting airline. I'm keen to hear what you guys have to say about it.
And speaking of Global Airlines, you're going to have to wait till next week because the remainder of what we have to catch up in the aviation industry is going to be returning next week, and we will see you then.
See you later.